green flag.
Just go from one thing to another, apparently, it's a radio station. But they don't know what subject they're on.
I guess that, you know, is part of, for some people that are young don't, still can't do that.
No.
You know, so it's not any function of age.
No.
I don't know, he was a funny kid. But I thought he wanted a job, you know, and I told him once before when he first came there that when his project with you was finished, he could have a job, you know, in the office. And he never, I'd like to know what happened to him, whether he, you know.
Well, I remember when we were talking about that out here that night, remember you started talking and you were worrying about it. you had come along that same route.
Yeah.
Why is that mother ever cute? Why didn't you tell mother?
I sure did.
That was cute.
He might do the same thing I did. You know, after a while he'll decide that. That school is something you have to take seriously, and he'll come back here and work at it.
When I tell my with somebody who asked now, you got into all sorts of. You never did just go to school. You moonlighted and everything else.
I came up here and went to school and pharmacy. Why, I don't know. Why pharmacy, I don't know. But anyway, I guess I had itchy pants just like Brock does. I couldn't sit still for a minute, you know, so I first thing I did was I got a job making slides for the biology department.
Oh.
That was my first, that was the first job I had. That was on the campus.
Now
then,
that would take a pretty steady hand too, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, and you had to do that in, you couldn't do that an hour or so at a time like Bronk would pop into this job. You had to spend a little time at that. But I'd go over there in the evenings. I had a key to the building and I had a key to the dark room, and so I could go over there most any time I wanted and work on my slides. And I was supposed to put in 15 hours a week or something. I forget what it was. And then my grades started to go to pot. So they wouldn't let me work on campus. So I went off campus to work. And
they catch up with you like that.
Oh, yeah.
See,
beginning of every semester or trimester or quarter or whatever the term is, you got to get a work permit to go back to work.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And they check your grades. So anyway, they wouldn't let me go back to work. So I don't know if I had already met Earl Jernigan somewhere. I guess I had. I don't know how. Somebody must have introduced me to Earl or something. Anyway, I knew Earl Jernigan. He was the projectionist at that time at the State Theater, and then he operated his own business at home whenever he wasn't being projectionist at the State Theater.
Oh.
So I was down there talking to him one day, and I said, I really do need a job. And he
you
said,
were about 18.
Uh-huh, 18. Mm-hmm. He said, well, he said, why don't you come down here and work? He said, the guy who's managing this theater really needs some help. He said, look out there. He said, half the exit lights are burned out. He said, half the aisle lights are burned out. He said, the guy's not here enough to even pay attention to the theater. So I went down and talked to the manager. And the manager was a guy by the name of Ron Sales, and he was British. And so he wasn't sure he needed any help running his theater, but he figured that he would give me a job doing something. So I was the doorman, you know, the guy that stands there and carries the tickets. Well, that didn't last long. He decided he wanted to go somewhere, and he decided that I knew a little bit about the movie business, I guess.
Did you?
Yeah. I had been a all the time I was in high school, I'd been an usher at a theater in Miami, see, so he called me into the office one afternoon.
Well, you
and
see,
he
that's
said,
what happened to Brock. That was back and he run this radio station.
Yeah.
That's right. That's why he
came. I'm telling you, you learned early.
He called me in the office one day and he says, I've got to go on this trip, and he said, I need you to take care of this theater while I'm gone. So he hands me this big ring of keys. He said, these are all keys. And he said, now you're going to have to learn this combination to this safe. So he gave me the combination of the safe and kept the money and the ticket. And I had to learn right quick how to open the theater in the afternoon, check the tickets out to the cashier, open the candy counter, get the theater started, work the stupid theater all day long, make out the box office report at night.
Oh, gracious.
You know, and the box office report is as big as this table. You stretch it out on the desk and you start up in that corner and you start working and you tell everything that happened and, it's all little blocks and that you fill out and, all the beginning and ending ticket numbers and the money you collected and how much you sold at the candy counter and what the weather was and what the film was and what the, God. And
all that stuff?
Yeah, every day. And you on.
You mean they end on paperwork too?
Oh yeah, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, you send a copy of you airmail special delivery a copy of the box office report to New York, and you deposit the money that you collected on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Every night you deposit the money at the bank in the night depository thing. Then on Thursday you start putting the money in the safe. You put Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays money in. Well, not Sundays. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday go in the safe, and then Sunday you make up the payroll and you pay everybody that works at the theater. Then you deposit at the bank what's left over on Sunday night. So that got to be a full-time job working at that theater. When sales came back and everything had run smooth while he was gone, he took off again. It turns out, later I found out, he was looking for another job.
Uh-huh.
He didn't like the company that we were working for. And the company didn't know that I was running the theater until later. And one time while he was gone, I had an argument with the guy who was doing our booking in Jacksonville, so I decided I could book as good a film as he could. I started doing my own booking, and which was not hard to do because you book through Jacksonville, so all you got to do is call them up, argue with them about what the way they're going to have to come up with the cost. Did my own ads and the paper and did everything. So that semester, I failed half the courses I was taking.
Yeah.
One of the things I failed was chemistry. And I failed it because I was repeating it from where I had made a D in it, and the second time around I failed it completely. And the reason I failed it was because I wasn't going to the lab and doing the experiments. I had already done all the experiments before anyway, so I was just writing the experiments in the book, you know, and they caught me doing that. So I had to,
Debbie, come on in here. We got something here.
Well,
you know, when you got
kind of being so
busy,
I'll tell you. Or a theater.
Right back up on that theater. You see, he had a job on the campus, but it took much time. He didn't pass enough classes, so they wouldn't let him work on the campus.
I made such lousy grades, they wouldn't let me work on the campus.
So he had to work off.
And, you know, it's very strange that somebody who had as much trouble getting through school as I had would wind up on the faculty. I don't know that that says much for the University of Florida's choice of faculty members. But after I lost my job on the campus, I had to go off campus to look for a job, and I wound up working at the State Theater. And I wound up running it through just a slow evolution. Earl Jernigan, yeah, he was the professor. Now he's in business for himself now. He doesn't. Yeah. And my folks, what's really funny is my folks thought, I knew my school career was coming to a fast close. And my folks thought that I was unhappy. And so in order to bribe me to stay in school, they bought me a car, which wasn't too smart. And because that made matters even worse. And, oh boy, my mother was mad, you know, when I got thrown out of school. And I mean, I really got thrown out. They said, don't come back.
But that was the second
time. No, that was the first time I got, no. I went to school, I started in September of 52, and I went to the fall semester and the winter semester and summer school and back into the fall semester again of 53 and the winter semester of 53. And it was at the end of the winter semester or the spring or whatever they call it in the semester system. It was in June of 54 that the University of Florida said to me, Ben, as you have failed half the courses you are taking this term, you are hereby requested not to come back for at least one semester.
Well, now, was that after your biology thing, or was that long later?
No, but I did the biology thing as a freshman.
Yeah.
And when I was a sophomore, supposed to be a sophomore, that's when I worked at the State Theater.
You ran the State Theater.
But they didn't fit the odds when you
Mm-hmm. I was still working at the theater when the university suspended me. And my bright idea was I was going to stay in Gainesville and keep on working at the theater, even though I wasn't going to school. Well, my mother decided that that was not such a good idea. So I had to go home.
Let me tell you, before you do that, all the things you did now at the theater.
But the guy wasn't too enthusiastic about hiring me upstairs, but he decided that he'd give me a job. So he gave me a job tearing tickets at the door, you know. And I did that for a week. And he and I got along pretty good during that week. And so he said, calls me in on the weekend. And he said he had to go somewhere. And he needed somebody to take care of the theater while he was gone. And he asked me, he said, have you have you done, see, I had worked with a student of mine when I was in high school, a big theater downtown. He said, do you know about checking in out the cashier with their tickets and everything, and opening and closing the same account? I said, oh, sure, you know. I knew how the Paramount Theater in Miami did it. I didn't know how the State Theater in Gainesville did it, but I figured it couldn't be any worse. And he says, okay. And he gives me this big ring of keys and the combination to the safe. And he says, you know, you take care of this place and it's while I go. The theater was owned by a company in New York called the B.S. Moss Circuit. I don't know why they call theaters instead of companies. They call them circuits. They had 50-some-odd theaters in New York City and the surrounding areas, Long Island and Staten Island. And four theaters in Florida. The theaters they had in Florida were, they must have bought these theaters in Florida for tax write-off purposes, because they certainly weren't trying to make any money with the theaters in Florida. And anyway, turns out that he was not happy working for this B.S. Moss outfit, and apparently they weren't happy with him either, because they transferred him from New York to Florida. And so he was taken off looking for another job, and he left me at 19 years old with a theater. And so...
And that weekly report.
Yeah, the box office report and includes the candy count and everything, and you write down everything that happened that could conceivably relate to the theater during the day. The opening and closing ticket numbers, and you know, theaters now just have one or two prices that they hold all day long. Well, we had three different kinds of tickets we sold before 6 o'clock, and three kinds of tickets we sold after 6 o'clock. Our prices went up at 6 o'clock. I remember kids, if you were a kid, if you were under 12, and it was before 6 o'clock in the evening, it would only cost 14 cents to get in the theater. I remember that. I can't remember any of the other prices. I think it was 50 cents for adults. And then we charged extra, or less, to sit in the balcony. I don't know. Anyway, I stopped using the balcony tickets. I decided that was too much summer. But anyway, you had to give all the opening and closing ticket numbers on all of those tickets. You had to figure the state tax and the federal tax on all those tickets.
Every day.
You had to write in your complete time schedule for the one complete show during the day. In other words, you had to write in the block where it said feature, you know, feature one and feature two, but sometimes we didn't have a double feature. The name of the film and the number of running minutes, 90 minutes, 91 minutes, or 89 minutes, or whatever it was. Then you wrote in the number of the newsreel. We're still showing newsreels then. Most people now don't even know what a newsreel is. And short subjects and cartoons, all those had to be listed in their running minutes. Then you had to give the starting times of each complete show, so they would know how many shows you ran during the day and what time you opened and what time you closed. And then you had to put what the weather was every 2 hours during the day.
Weather?
Yeah, whether it was cloudy or rainy or the sun was shining or whatever. There's some correlation between the weather and whether people go to the movies or not, is the idea.
Is it
raining,
they go?
Or don't go. I don't know. I never could get the correlation myself. It seemed to me there was more correlation between the movie you were playing and whether they came to the theater or not. And, all that had to be done every day. Also, the candy counter had to be checked in and out every day. And then once a week, you had to take an inventory of the candy counter. You count all the candy and the ice cream and the popcorn. And when you count popcorn...
By the kernel?
By bags. You know how many boxes you buy to put the popcorn in, and you count them, and you charge them into the candy counter, and then you count how many you got left, and that tells you how many boxes of popcorn you sold. And, that way you know whether your candy counter is over or short, you know. So he left me with all of this. And I, you know, he was gone longer than he expected to be gone. And I was getting ready to close one night, and Earl comes down and he says, do you know what to do about the film? And I said, what film? And he said, well, he said, we change programs tomorrow. And he said, the film we got up there in the booth tonight has got to go out and the new film's got to come in. And I said, well, how does this happen, you know? Well, so he sat down and explained to me how it worked. And that's very interesting because the film moves, at least in our theater, it moves by Benton Brothers Film Express, and they drive their big trucks around the state all night long. And they might come to the state theater at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And what you do is you bring your outgoing film down and you set it in the lobby right in front of the door. And Benton Brothers has a key. Each truck driver has a key to every theater that's on his route. And he uses his key, opens the door to the theater, he picks up your film that's going out, he leaves you the film that's coming in. So the next morning when you open the theater, there it is sitting right in the lobby, and you take it upstairs. And it comes, the film comes in shipping cases, and it comes on shipping reels. And the shipping reels, you're not supposed to use a shipping reel in a projector because they're bent and they don't always, they're just sturdy enough to hold the film together during shipment. So you have to take the projectionist has to get there early before the first show in the day you're starting a new program because he has to take all that film off the shipping reels and put it on the regular theater reels, which are very heavy. And you use those all during the week that you're showing the film. Then when the film goes out, you put it back on the shipping reels again. Film is always shipped with the inside out, in other words, with the tail of each reel out toward the outside reel, see? So that when you get the film in, all you got to do is wind it once onto your reel from the shipping reel and it's ready to put on the projector. So at night, when you're showing that film for the last time, it means you've got to wind it onto one of your house reels. But it's got to be shipped tails out and its heads out when you wind it onto the house reel. So you got to put it in the rewind cabinet and wind it onto another house reel, heads out, then wind it back onto the shipping reel and tails up. So what you do if you're lazy, especially when you're closing the theater at 1 o'clock in the morning and it's not too much fun to be sitting up there winding all that film, you put one of your, when you get that particular reel on the projector, you put the shipping reel on the bottom magazine so that your film winds onto the shipping reel while it's being run. And then it's there, tails out, and you just put it in the shipping case. But you've got to leave the magazine doors of the projector open because the reels are so warped and bent that they're liable to get stuck in the magazine. So you leave the magazine doors open. Now that's okay, except that if the fire marshal happens to come by and you're operating your projectors with the doors open, he'll make you close the theater right in the middle of the show. And that's very embarrassing when you have to, you know, shut the theater down and refund everybody's money. So you usually have a signal arrangement, you see, and if you recognize the fire marshal, because he goes around the theaters during their last show because he knows they do that. And if you recognize him, you buzz up to the projection booth and the projectionist tries to get the film off and back on, or at least he closes the door and hopes it won't jam. Because the fire marshal doesn't care whether you're using the shipping reel or the house reel as long as the film doesn't, you know, as long as you got the doors closed. The things you learn, miscellaneous information, you know, that really doesn't do anybody any good. But, so I made the arrangements to get the film in and out. And sales comes back and takes off again. And he does this, like, for 6 weeks in a row. He's in for a couple of days. Now, the company doesn't know that I'm running the theater. So I make out all the funds, but I don't sign anything. Because I can't, you know, they don't know me. They don't even know I'm on the payroll. And so... One day he's there, and he's signing everything, and he says, I've got to go somewhere, Orlando, somewhere. He says, you're going to have to make up the ad for the newspaper. I said, what? Because, see, when I worked at the Paramount Theater in Miami, Florida State Theaters made the ads for the papers. We didn't even understand. So I found out how you do that. You buy what's called map books on each film you order. You buy a map book, and it's a paper, kind of like real thick paper with the image of the ad crushed into the paper. And you cut the one you want to run out, and you send it to the newspaper. And that paper is treated with asbestos, and they fill that paper up with hot lead and let it cool, and that makes thing they print the newspaper with. So, all, you know, you learn all sorts of fascinating little things that you never knew about before.
I didn't know how to use it.
And, of course, I thought, well, you know, this is great, you know. So I'd go through the map book, and I'd find some great big ad like this, and I'd cut it out, you know, and send it to the Gainesville Sun here at the State Theater and have a half a page ad for a movie. And we got the bill for it, and they had a fit, you know, because we weren't supposed to spend that much money on advertising. And another thing I did is, CinemaScope was just coming in to being, you see, and while he was gone on one of his trips, he said that he didn't tell me, he didn't even warn me, but this guy shows up and he's selling lenses, you know, and he tells me that Mr. Fales has made arrangements to buy these CinemaScope lenses, and I said, oh good, you know, because we had a bunch of CinemaScope movies booked. So I knew we had to put the lenses in right away, otherwise we'd get the movies in and wouldn't be able to run them if we didn't have the CinemaScope lenses. So this salesman was pretty clever. He sees that I didn't know what anything from anything, you know, I just wasn't sitting there. And the company had bought some cheap CinemaScope lenses. And I had heard the projectionist complain, and the one who was my friend, had complained that these lenses they had ordered weren't very good and wouldn't put a very good picture on the screen. So he said, you've ordered prismatic lenses. They're lenses that widen the picture out with prisms instead of doing it in the lens. And it takes a lot of light through those prisms. And he said, I told Mr. Fales, he said, these lenses are not, you know, not going to make a very good picture for you in this theater because of your screen and because of your projection. And I said, well, I said, what lenses should we get? He showed me these great big CinemaScope lenses, you know, that were the best in the line. This guy's from Bausch & Lomb, you know, and you don't buy any better lenses than Bausch & Lomb lenses. And so I said, oh, well, I said, I'll take, why don't we get these instead of these? And the lenses were $3,000 a pair. And I bought them. The company had a fit about that. But Fales couldn't fuss at me because he was supposed to be there. I wasn't. And so he had to take the blame for buying the lenses, you see, because I wasn't supposed to be having anything to do with it. And
he was standing well, by
the way. Yeah, yeah. Boy, the company really was. So then one day, while he was gone. Now, this was after he finally told me. He said, look, he said, I'm trying to find another job. And he said, if you'll stay here and run this theater, he said, I'll pay you whatever he could pay me. He finally told the company that he'd hired an assistant manager, but they wouldn't let him pay me very much. I think $60 a week or something was all I could make. Well, this was in 1953, so, you know, and I was in school, and I was having a ball anyway, so I didn't really care.
Yeah.
And he was making $125 a week, which was not particularly good, but it wasn't too bad for 1953 or so. He says, if you'll stay here and manage this theater while I go out and look for another job, he said, I'll pay you. In other words, we were going to add his salary and my salary together and split it. So that's what, 125 and 60 is 185. So each of us was getting like 92.50 or something like that. And so it freed him up, you know, to not have to worry. So really the theater was mine. In the meantime, we had gotten permission from the company that I could sign all the reports except the manager's weekly statement. But I'd make that up and he'd come by every once in a while and sign it. But sometimes I wouldn't see him for 5 or 6 weeks.
Oh,
yeah. And except on Sunday night when you come to sign the manager's weekly statement. So we were getting our films through this guy in Jacksonville. I forget his name now, but he's a private booker, and that's all he does is he books films through the film exchanges, 20th Century Fox, International University, for independent theaters that are not big chains. Like, you know, Florida State Theaters and New Metro has their own booking that they do centrally. So, this one particular week, he had booked in an Alec Guinness movie and some other nondescript movie, just to run as what we call a second half, was double feature. So I called him up and I said, if you would understand the kind of audience we deal with in Gainesville, as opposed to Jacksonville, I said, you would know that we don't have to run anything with an Alec Guinness movie. I said, I can run any movie here in Gainesville that Alec Guinness ever made and pack the place without having to run it as a double feature. Now, you can't do that today, of course, because people are looking for something different in movies, not looking for Alec Guinness anymore. But in 1953, you could put an Alec Guinness in the movie. He said, no, he said, an Alec Guinness movie won't stand alone. I said, well, it will in Gainesville. I said, I don't think an Alec Guinness movie would stand alone in Jacksonville, but I said, it will in Gainesville. Because I said, you're dealing with a more sophisticated audience in Gainesville than you are in Jacksonville. No. Yeah. So, there's in 35 millimeter film that's used professionally in theaters, it comes with a paper band around the film and then a string around that, and there's a little paper seal on it. Now, there's no way you can get the film off that reel without breaking that seal. So if you run the film, you got to break the seal. If you don't run the film and you don't break the seal, you don't have to pay for it, even though the company has shipped it to you. Now, in 16 millimeter, you pay for it whether you run it or not. But in 35 millimeter. And I said, you send me that film. I said, I'm not going to run it. And he said, you don't run it. He said, I'll have your job, because they get... Like if it's a Warner Brothers movie and you don't run it, Warner Brothers gets very upset because the movie's been tied up all that time, you know. But they get upset with the booker, not the theater manager. And so I said, well, you can have my job if you want, but I said, I'm not going to open that film. So I didn't. So there was all kinds of letters transpired between me and New York and the booker and Warner Brothers, you know. And I really thought I was going to lose my job, you know. But I really didn't care. I guess I knew my days in school were starting to be numbered, so I really didn't care. So, lo and behold, the company praises me for my actions, because we made a small fortune with that Alec Guinness movie and avoided the film rental on this other film. So the company thought that was great. And the booker was very upset because the company wouldn't fire me. So he was being not very nice. So I said, I figured, well, I've got this far, I can go a little further. So I told the booker he was fired. I said, I'll do my own booking. He says, you don't know anything about booking. And I said, I don't know anything about running a theater either. But I said, I've learned. And I said, I can learn how to do my own booking. So again, lots of letters back and forth between New York and me and the booker. So finally, New York says, lo and behold, go ahead and do your own booking, if that's the way you feel about it. Because they pay this booker a small fortune to book these things. So I was in, hog heaven. I'd go to Jacksonville every Saturday and book. You got to book like 6 weeks ahead of time. So every Saturday, I'd get on the bus and I'd go to Jacksonville. And I'd walk around to Warner Brothers and Universal. I wouldn't even go to the companies who do this. I'd go right to the exchanges. And they'd look at me like I was crazy. I was coming from this stupid little 1,200-seat theater in Gainesville, and I was wanting to deal directly with Universal and Fox. But I guess they thought it was funny, you know. And I was willing to book stuff that other theaters didn't want. I was in the process of turning the State Theater into an art house, not a sexy art house, but a real art. In other words, I was going back and booking classic films, you know. I got this wild idea one time that I was going to run this marathon double feature, and I booked Stalag 17 and Roman Holiday in the same double feature. So when you came to look at both movies, you were in the theater for 6 hours. By the time we showed all the newsreels and the short subjects and Stalag 17 and Roman Holiday, you walked out, your eyeballs were coming out of your head because you'd been in there for 6 hours. You know. But we made a fortune, and the reason we made a fortune was not because why I thought we'd make a fortune. I thought people would come and see those two stupid long movies together, but they didn't. They were such different movies that the type of person that Selleck 17 would appeal to didn't want to watch Roman Holiday, and the type of person that Roman Holiday, and I packed, I was running a double feature, yet I was packing the theater, and I was getting a turnover on every feature instead of them staying for the double feature. I didn't, that's not what I had in mind when I did it, but that's the way it turned out. But I was like the hero of the company because I had made all this money, and that didn't mean what I intended to do. I thought it was going to work the other way around. But anyway, I got to the point where I could do my own bookings, write up my own ads, do all the reports and everything. But you know how many hours a week I was working either in or for the State Theater? 80 hours a week. Counting the time I was going to Jacksonville and
you didn't get to class.
Yeah, I went to class in the morning. We didn't open the theater until we were opening the theater when I first started working. They were opening the theater at 10:45 in the morning and hitting the screen at 11 o'clock, and I just thought that was ridiculous because 90% of the time we were going on the screen with nobody in the theater, you know. Now, we weren't actually putting a picture on the screen. We'd leave the lamp houses on the projectors turned off, and we'd leave the amplifier for the sound turned off, and sometimes we'd even leave the air conditioning turned off if it wasn't too hot. And we'd let the film run, the film just running through the projector with no light on or anything. Then if somebody bought a ticket, the girl in the box office would buzz the projection booth, and he'd turn on the amplifier in the lamp house, and then we'd be where we were supposed to be. If we didn't run the film at all, and somebody came in, it would take us 15 minutes to get on the screen because we'd have to find the right reel that we should be in. Because you change reels every 12 to 15 minutes, so you'd have to know the running time of each reel, and you'd have to count down to see what reel you were supposed to be in. And then you might not be in the right spot in the reel, you know, because you can't start in the middle, so you have to start at the beginning. So if you were supposed to be halfway through reel 5 when somebody came in, you'd be 6 minutes behind schedule already. And the projectionist, Earl Jernigan, prided him. There was a big sweet second hand on his clock. And he would figure our schedule. You know, most theaters give you the time the movie's going to start, for the nearest 15 minutes or so, maybe 5 if they're real accurate. But we used to post our schedule downstairs accurate to the minute. But Earl kept his schedule up in the projection booth to the second.
Oh.
And he measured every inch of film that was going to go through the projectors. And you know that the film goes 90 feet a minute. So if you've got 45 feet of film, you know that's going to take 30 seconds to run through the projectors. So his schedule was, you know, the newsreel was going to start at 12:29 and 32 seconds. And he watched the sweet second hand on his phone, and he would stay right on schedule all the way. And so that's why we had to run the film. Anyway, my grades came out. And I had flunked past the courses I was taking. And the university suspended me.
The reason to stay in so long when you weren't doing well in school was in semesters.
Semesters, right.
That makes a whole lot of difference.
Sure, that's 4.5 months you're in school, whether you're doing bad or not.
Yeah.
As opposed to 3 months. So my mother says, you know, no, you're not going to stay in Greensboro and work at the State Theater. You're going to come home. So I went home and jobs weren't too easy to come by, and I don't know if there was some kind of economic difficulties at that time or not. In June of 54. And I had to go to summer camp because I was also, in addition to all this, I was in the Army Reserve. So I couldn't really get a job somewhere, and instead I had to go to summer camp. So I sort of loafed around home, and when I was in high school, for a while I worked at night showing movies in hotels on Miami Beach. You can always tell that anything I've ever done in my life is centered around what I'm doing now. was a, they called it Universal Motion Picture Service, or International Motion Picture Service, something like that. And what we did is every night, or almost every night, we would show movies in hotels on the beach, part of the Miami Beach hotels, trying to entertain their guests. And how we got away with it, I don't know, because they're operating in direct competition with the theater. But we weren't showing as good of movies as they were showing. We're showing older movies, of course, and they were showing. But you went, if you were one of their projectionists, you went. Now, this, you know, what you'll do for a few dollars. I'd have to drive my own car to Miami Beach from Miami to Miami Beach. I have to be there by 7:30. And there was this big board, and it told you which projector to take, and which lens to take, and which screen to take, and which movie to take. And you pack all this stuff into your car, and you drive all the way up. You know, it might be a long way, or it might not be so far. The office was on 2nd Street on South Beach. So if you had a South Beach hotel, it wasn't too bad, but usually you had to drive way up. Like, sometimes I had to drive from South Beach to the Golden Gate, which is in Golden Beach, which is way up the beach, you know. You pack all that stuff into the hotel, you set up the screen, you set up the projector, you run this whole movie. Usually the movie starts at 9 o'clock. So you run this whole movie, it usually includes the cartoon and all that stuff, so you're finished at 10:45 or 11 o'clock. Take all that stuff down, put it back in your car, drive back to 2nd Street, put it all away, then drive home. I was lucky to get home at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know. Now, naturally, while I was in high school, my mother would only let me do that, like, on Friday and Saturday night. But they don't show too many movies on Saturday, and for years I was only doing it on Friday. Well, anyway, when I went home, since I didn't have a job, and I didn't want to go to work for a major company with having to leave for Army Reserve Camp, I went over to Miami Beach and got back on this tour showing these movies, and I would usually go movies 5 nights a week. And that gave me spending money, because for all this ritual, and after using your own car, you know how much they paid you to show, per night to show those movies?
$5.
$5.
Yeah.
$5. My father said, "You are so stupid." He said, "You're putting $5 worth of wear and tear on your car." You know, or on his car, whichever the case might be. But it was something to do, and it was, you know, I thought I was making money out of it. I wasn't really. So when I got back from Army Reserve Camp, my mother says, "Well," she says, "I don't care if you go to work or not, but, you know, they had bought me this car." Up here. She said, "But you got to start making your own car payment." I think they were like $24 a month or something like that. It was a 49 summer. So she wanted me to go to work for a telephone company, and I went down to apply at the telephone company, but they didn't seem to be terribly interested. So I checked around several places. I couldn't find a job. And so my father says, "Well," he said, "if you don't mind, your father, using whatever influence he's got to get you a job," he said, I'll see if I can help you find a job." I said, "I don't mind." So he got me a job at Eastern Airlines.
Oh, that's
the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't know what was going on.
So I worked for Eastern Airlines. And what he had done is I remember now, this guy, when I was just like 5 or 6 years old, we weren't very, my family wasn't very well off at that time. I mean, we had our own home, but, let's see, I was 5 years old, that was 39, that's 40. And the Depression was, I guess, just getting over or something. And I remember that we took this guy, we left this, we rented this guy a room in our house, is what it amounted to. And he was working for Eastern Airlines. And he came from Birmingham, Alabama, and he had been a cop in Birmingham. And We had a three-bedroom house, so it was no big deal. My folks slept in the front bedroom, I slept in the middle bedroom, and he slept in the back bedroom. And my mother was cleaning his room up one day, and she found a gun in his room, a revolver, a poison. And I remember she was so scared. And that's when we found out, we didn't know he'd been a cop in Birmingham. That's when we found out he'd been a cop, so that's why he had the gun, so everything was all right. But I know my mother was always nervous about him living there. And it turns out that that's how my father got me the job at Eastern Airlines, because I must have been 5 or 6 when he moved in with us, and I was 20 when I went to work for Eastern Airlines, 19, or whenever I got from there. So in those 14 years or so, he had gone to the point where he was one of the assistant vice presidents of Eastern Airlines. He was the controller of Eastern Airlines is a vice president. But they don't call him vice president, they call him controller, but he's on the same level as the vice president. Well, Wayne Dean was the assistant controller. And that's how my father got me the job at Eastern Airlines. Because I really didn't know, you know, what was happening. All I know is my father made a phone call, and I went out and you know, the next thing I know, I was delivering mail at Eastern Airlines, you know. But apparently, Wayne Dean was helping me get along at Eastern, so I moved from the mail room to a dressograph, and then I moved into accounting and payroll department. In the meantime, this friend of mine took a job with RCA in the Bahamas. So he came back one weekend from the Bahamas, and he said, you got to quit Eastern Airlines and come to work for RCA. He said, this is a real kick. He said, you go down to the Bahamas and you get all this extra money, and they supply you, you know, they feed you, and they supply you a place to live. And I said, who wants to go to the Bahamas, you know? So anyway, he kept working on me. So finally, much to my mother's horror, I drove one weekend up to Patrick Air Force Base and applied for a job with RCA. It was the guided missile testing range is what it was, and it was headquartered at Patrick Air Force Base. It still is.
What's that now?
It was a guided missile testing range for RCA.
Oh,
and that particular project was headquartered at Patrick Air Force Base.
Yeah.
So,
now that was going to get you to the Bahamas.
Yeah. The missile test range now, of course, is practically all over. But at that time, in the early stages of firing these missiles, the missile range started out at Cape Canaveral, that's where the missiles were and still are launched. And the missile test range was Grand Bahama, Eleuthera, San Salvador, Mayaguana, and Grand Turk. And if we had a missile that got as far as Grand Turk, it was considered to be a miracle. You know, most of them didn't even make it to Grand Bahama. So they were like the first missiles. They were Snark and Bomark. Anyway, it used to be a big joke when they'd fire a Snark. It would take off. They weren't anything more than little tiny radio controlled jet planes, is about all they amounted to, with little short stubby wings. And the joke was, they talked about the Snark infested waters of Cape Canaveral, because the things would just barely make it to the ocean and plop in, you know. So I went up there and I went through all this rigmarole, you know, to apply for this job. So in the meantime, I had asked Fred, I said, Fred was working for the telephone company when he went to Grand Bahama, and they have a telephone system down there, so he had a job, you know. I said, what can I possibly do? You know, I haven't done anything except manage a theater, be terribly unsuccessful in school, and work in the payroll department at Eastern Airlines. I said, what would they want with me down there, you know? And he said, well, you know a lot about photography. Well, I did, because while I was in high school, my father, in junior high school, really, in the first part of high school, my father was a commercial photographer. But I said, you know, what if I need photography down in Grand Bahama? Well, it was true. They didn't need photographers on Grand Bahama, but they needed photographers at the Cape. And they kept bugging me about taking a job at the Cape. they call me practically every Monday morning. I could depend on the phone ringing while I was having breakfast, getting ready to go to work for Eastern Airlines. And it'd be this guy from RCA, and he'd say, are you sure you don't want to come up here to the tape and work? Because we desperately need photographers, movie photographers, and show photographers. And I said, no. I said, there's no percentage in me going to the tape to work, even for more money. Because I said, I'm living at home with my parents, and I work for Eastern Airlines. And I said, I've got a really nice arrangement. And I said, it doesn't cost me much to live at home. You know, I was paying my folks, you know, for the food and stuff. But I said, if I move and take a job at the Cape, I've got to rent myself an apartment to live in, you know. And I said, it just doesn't cost me more to work up there. So it's got to be a ritual every Monday morning to talk to this man on the phone, you know. So finally, one Monday morning, he calls, and before he said anything, he said, wait. He said, before you say no, he said, I got a job for you in Grand Bahama. And I said, doing photographic work? And he said, no. He said, it's a clerical job. Apparently on every island, RCA has somebody who takes care of all the paperwork, you know. And he said, it's just a clerk's job, but he said, you know, it pays. It paid about what I was making at Eastern, but you get a 10% bonus for being overseas. Overseas is 60 miles off the coast of West Palm Beach, you know, but you're overseas. You could practically swim, you know, to West Palm Beach. But, and you got room and board, of course, supplied and all kinds of other things. So I said, okay. So off I went to Grand Bahama. I went in and quit at Eastern Airlines and went to the Sunday Sunday and stuff. And went to West Palm and Grand Bahama. And RCA was worried about my draft status. RCA wasn't. I was worried about my draft status. I said, are you sure you want me to go down there to work? Because I said, I'm liable to be drafted. And RCA said, no way you're going to get drafted. They said, you're doing essential government missile test work, even though you're only a clerk. So you can't get drafted. You get an exemption. I said, okay, that's just me. I didn't want to go anyway, you know. So I go down there, and I'm down there for about 2 years, I guess. Maybe not even 2 years. And, I took that job in November of 55, and I got drafted in March of 57. It wasn't even 2 years. So lo and behold, one day, you know, my mother sends me this emergency message through West End, because Grand Bahama wasn't what it is today. There was nothing on that Cotton Island. You know, now it's a big tourist attraction, the big hotels and gambling casinos and everything. When I was down there, there wasn't a thing. There was a crummy hotel at West End which managed to get one or two rooms open, you know, for the weekend, and then practically shut down the rest of the week. Anyway, my mother somehow got me a radio message. Oh, I know what she did. She called Kate, and they sent me a teletype message. They didn't like to do this, but they did it. And my mother informed me that I'm about to be drafted. So I informed RCA, yeah, look, you told me I wasn't going to get drafted, and here it is, I'm getting drafted. So they tried to pull all kinds of strings, but I was registered with the one draft board in the whole state of Florida who decided that just because you were working on that missile test project, you weren't any more essential than the guy who's pumping gas in the corner filling station, and that you go just like everybody else goes. So I thought, now, you know, the last thing I wanted to do was go in the Army, and I thought to myself, what am I going to do, you know? So I caught a plane, and I went back to Miami, and I went to see the draft board, and the woman at the draft board, she says, I'm terribly sorry, but she said, your draft notice has already been mailed. And she said, the law says that when I drop that draft notice through the slot of the mailbox, you're drafted, whether you get it or not, you know? It was the day and time she drops that notice in the mailbox is the day and time it's too late to join any other branch of the service. So I thought I'd resign myself to going in the Army, even though I really wanted to go in the Air Force. So I go home, and I'm very glum, and that evening, lo and behold, comes my draft notice. And but I noticed that they had made a mistake. My draft notice says that I'm supposed to report. Something or other. And up at the top of the notice, it says date of mailing of this notice, April something or other, which was only like 3 days before I'm supposed to report. But this was still March. And what she had done is, in stamping the draft notices, she had forgotten to set the thing back to March, so she had stamped it with the right date. But she had not moved the month back to March. So the draft notice was dated in April, and I was supposed to report in April. And the law required at that time that you have 30 days notice. Now, I had 30 days notice because I received the notice 33 days before I was supposed to go, but the notice said in writing that I only had 3 days to report. So I thought, well, that doesn't make any difference. Now I got the notice, and this is still March, and there's no way I could prove it was April. So the next morning, I took the draft notice down to the draft board, to the one that's draft board, and I said, I think you must have made an error in the draft notice. And she said, oh, I certainly did. She said, did you say you want to join the Air Force? And I said, yes. And she said, well, you better go do it right now. Because she said, that notice is not worth the paper it's written on. And she said, I'm going to have to redo them all and mail them out today. And so she said, if you want to join the Air Force, she said, you go do it before noon. Because she said, it'll take me about that long to get the draft notice. And now if I jumped in the car and ran down to the Air Force for Christmas, it's I don't think we got that far the other time when I was here. I think we got so bogged down in my sparkling college career that
this is incredible. That. And now, where did this Air Force
take you? Well, the first place I went in the Air Force was I don't know why I was such a homebody. Now I'd give anything to go anywhere. But at that time I wanted to be close to home. You know, I guess that's a function of age, I'm sure. And so the Air Force sent me first to Lackland Air Force Base, which is where everybody goes for basic training. And because of my background working down with RCA on guided missiles, even though I was just... Well, by the time I left, by the time I was drafted, or by the time I joined the Air Force, I wasn't working a clerical job anymore. I was what they called communications coordinator. And during the day, I did clerical work, but during a missile shot, I sat at this big console, and I made sure all the radio circuits were on the right frequencies, and all the telephones worked, and all the hotlines were hooked up to the right places. And we had what we called a green phone system. It was a phone without a dial on it. And like certain phones were connected to certain other phones, and you could discuss classified information on these phones because they couldn't be tapped into. There's no way you could tap into this phone system. In other words, the only person who could tap into that phone system was me sitting at that phone cell. And I was clearing through all that security information. So, in other words, you could pick up the dial phone system and talk to somebody on that phone by just dialing the number. But you couldn't discuss classified information on that phone because anybody anywhere along the line could tap into the lines and listen. But you could discuss classified information on the green phones. Well, my job was to make sure the right green phones were connecting to the right other green phones. In other words, the instrumentation manager's green phone might go to the radar manager's green phone. You know, but only two phones could be connected together in pairs. And we had a total of like 25 of those phones, but they had to be in twos. And I had to make sure all those went to the right places, and it was a good job, and it paid a small fortune. Yeah.
Communications. So that helped you in there.
Yeah. So at least, you know, even though I hadn't touched a missile or didn't know anything about how they work, I had some experience with what the names of the missiles were and how fast they would go and what their flight history had been and everything. So the Air Force decided that they wanted me to work unguided missiles. And I was supposed to go to school after I left Lackland for us to go to school in Denver, which would have been fantastic. You know, I've never been to Denver, and I've always wanted to go there. I'd still like to go to Denver. And so, not forever, just a visit. So I thought, you know, that's going to be nice if I go to Denver. Well, then I got to talking to this guy, and he said, look, he said, what you've been doing with guided missiles and what they do with guided missiles in Denver are two entirely different things. And he said, although it seems logical at first glance for you to go to Denver, he said, I don't think you're really going to like what you're going to get into in Denver, because he said, what you're going to be trained for in Denver is to be a mechanic on these missiles, you know. And you're not going to be working in electronics or anything else. He said, what you're going to be is a glorified jet plane mechanic. And he said, I don't think that's what you're going to do. And I said, no, that is definitely not what I'm going to do. So he said, first they were going to send me to some kind of communications school. And then he said, are you interested in radar? And I said, yeah. I said, radar sounds like it might be fun, but I said, I don't have any experience in radar. And he said, well, he said, and I had also expressed a desire that what I wanted to do while I was in the Air Force was to go to some kind of school. The longer, the better, you know. And so he said, the longest school we got going is basic electronics school and radar school. He says, you can spend a year in school. I said, that's great, that's for me. So they sent me to Keesler Air Force Base. I went to basic electronics school for 26 weeks. And I went to radar school for another 26 weeks. I was in school for a year.
That's a long time.
Well, that's paid off, you see. You just know, you know, everything I've done in my life except, with the possible exception of the time I spent with Eastern Airlines, and that's been a help, you know, but everything I've done in my life has related to what I'm doing now.
Uh-huh. That's
you know,
fantastic.
All this electronics training I got has been useful to me. Mm-hmm. So, what I went to school on was the radar I really wanted to work on. I couldn't get into, I wasn't in the proper time sequence to get. I wanted to work on one of these Dew-line radars, the early warning radar systems, you know, that scan this. But I couldn't get into that because the school wasn't going to start for like. After I finished basic electronics school, the Dew-line radar school wasn't going to start for 13 weeks, so they wouldn't let me just sit around that long. So they sent me to GCA radar school, ground control to probe.
Oh.
And I wound up in air traffic control, bringing, you know, the GCA radar that brings planes in for a landing in cloudy and rainy weather.
And still, just a young thing.
Well, by now I'm 23, I guess. I was 22 when I went in the Air Force.
Yeah.
So I'm 23. So, this is the only Air Force base in the country that's completely surrounded by a town. The entire Air Force base is within the city limits or belongs to, you know, usually you're
yeah,
out.
Yeah,
you know.
That's right.
They had this deal going at Keesler. That if you graduated from this school with a grade of 95 or higher, you were to get your base of choice, or at least get in the area of where you wanted to go. As you know, services are notorious. You want to go to Florida, they send you to Maine or something like that.
Yeah.
So I really worked real hard, and I was interested in that school, and it was fascinating. And I graduated with honors, and they said, okay, where do you want to go? You had this regular form you filled out. And you specified three Air Force bases you wanted to go to. Then you specified, if not one of those three bases, you specified the state you wanted to go to, which was usually the state those three bases were in, you know, usually.
Yeah.
And so I said that I wanted to go to Homestead Air Force Base was my first choice because that was the closest base that I could to Miami, you know, practically in Miami. Then I said, Tyndall Air Force Base and up in the Panhandle was my second choice, and Eglin Air Force Base was my, no, I guess, McCoy. I could go to any Air Force Base that had runways because they've all got any Air Force Base with a runway, which most of them have. It's got a GCA in it, you know. There are Air Force sites that have just radar sets but no runways, so I couldn't go to any of those. So I guess I asked for Eglin Eglin, Tyndall, and Homestead, or McCoy, McGill, and Homestead, or some, anyway, bases in the Florida area. But one of the bases I had asked for was Eglin, up in the Panhandle. So they didn't have any of those bases available, and my state choice was, of course, Florida, and they didn't have any space or any, you know, positions available in Florida for my specialty, which was GCA. And of course, the area was just the 9 southeastern states, since, you know, included anything. So where do they send me? They send me to Moody Air Force Base in Valdosta, Georgia.
And that's right next door.
Yeah, next door to nothing. Oh, God, what an awful place. Moody is 14 miles from Valdosta over the lousiest road you ever want to go on. I tore up 2 sets of tires on my car driving back and forth from Moody to Valdosta. The problem was you drove 14 miles into Valdosta over this road that must have been made of razor blades because it could tear on 2 tires faster than anything I ever saw. And when you got to Valdosta, what? Nothing, you know, but at least it was, you know, at least it was a town. It wasn't an Air Force base. There was no Airman's Club. There was an NCO club, which had to be Staff Sergeant or better to go in the NCO club. And actually couldn't go in the Officers Club. They had a service club, but, you know, the things they do at a service club is like a USO thing or something. You know, they have dancing lessons and this sort of thing. The only thing to do that was at all entertaining to me was to go to the movies. Now, the closest town to Moody Air Force Base is a little town called Ray City, Georgia. And Ray City, Georgia, I think, has a population of 13 or something like that. It's got 2 filling stations, you know. God, I've never been in such a place in my life, you know. Here I've grown up in Miami, you know, and I'm sending to a place like that. The third day I was there, I had been to 3 movies so far. Because the base theater changed movies every night, fortunately, so you could go to the movies every night. And I was completely down, you know. The only thing that was good about being at Moody was the GCA unit had a lot of activity. Because it was a flight training base, we had 2 parallel north-south runways. We had the unit positioned in such so that we could do simultaneous final approaches to both runways, and it was just fascinating. We were just busy as we could be all day long. The unit was not open at night, so you didn't have to pull any night shifts. It was, you know, that part of it was nice. But then, so big deal, it's not open at night, so what do you do at night, you know? You go to the movies or sleep. So the third day I'm there, I'm out at work, and I'm sitting out there, and this staff sergeant comes up, and he and I had struck up a friendship, and I had been fussing about what a dull place they had sent me to. And he was grinning from ear to ear, just laughing. And I had noticed this smoke over on the main part of the base, and I thought to myself, gee, something's on fire over there. And he says, you'll never guess what's burning to the ground. I said, what? He said, the base movie theater. I thought, I wanted to kill myself. You know, the only entertainment I had been able to find for 3 days, and it was burning to the ground. And sure enough, it burned smack down to the absolute ground. Leveled.
Oh, my.
So.
Well, how long did you get to stay there?
I got to stay there 6 months. I volunteered. They every day on the board, or almost every day, they would post a list of APO numbers. They would, like, we were all in air traffic control, so we were all in the basic same group of skills, and they would write your AFSC, which is your code for the job you do, across the top of this form, and then they would list APO numbers that needed people with your specialty, you see. And if your specialty matched up with an APO number that you liked, you could fill out this form and you could request a transfer to that APO number in your specialty, see? Well, you had to go back over to the orderly room to see what the APO numbers meant, because it was just like APO 235, APO 237, I don't know. I didn't care what they meant, you know. I was willing to go to Turkey, Alaska, Japan. I didn't care what it was, you know. So I volunteered. I must have filled out 100 of these forms. I volunteered for everything, every APO number. Sometimes they would list my specialty and there was 7 APO numbers. I volunteered for all of them. I wouldn't even ask what they were. You know where I wound up? On Okinawa. I was thrilled to death because I thought I was going to Japan, and I had misread the middle digit of the APO number, and I was going to 235 instead of 225, and 235 was Naha Air Base Okinawa. 18 months. And everybody was teasing me, you know, Okinawa. You know, nobody goes to Okinawa. That's considered like going to Siberia or something, you know. But it really wasn't too bad.
18 months,
yeah, it wasn't really. It was just like being in Japan, except it wasn't quite as big. And
built up.
But Naha City is the capital city of Okinawa, and the population of Naha City is 600,000.
Good Lord.
No, 800,000.
I can't believe it. Okinawa.
You know, I knew how big Okinawa was, and my mother, you know, looked it up in the census or something, or some almanac or encyclopedia or something, and she says the population of the, you know, because I figured I was on some little island. She said the population of Naha City is 800,000. I said, God, everybody must have to stand up. You know, there wouldn't even be any room to sit down with 800,000 people. But it's a bigger island than it seems.
Yeah.
You know. And it was really an interesting place to be. There were like nightclubs and movie theaters.
Oh, yeah.
And all kinds of things to do. And
you got overseas pay.
Yeah, I guess I did. I don't know what.
Yeah.
There was some change in the pay for. But I guess you got a little more for going overseas. But it was not half bad. By 18 months, you were pretty sick of it, because you had seen every square inch of the island by the time 18 months had gone by. But, let's see, I spent a year in school and 6 months at Moody, and 18 months on Okinawa. So, I think somewhere in there I lost a few weeks. So, when I finished my 18 months staying on Okinawa, I had 13 months left in my enlistment. And the Air Force, by some major miracle, passed a new rule. In military terms, said if you are returning to the ZI, and the ZI means the United States of the Zone of the Interior, they call it, and you've got less than 15 months in your enlistment, you've either got to extend, re-enlist, or get out.
Oh, what a choice.
And I read that and I couldn't believe my eyes, you know. And so this guy says to me, he says, of course you're going to extend for 3 months. And I said, of course not. I said, I'm going to get out. And so I got out 13 months early. And I got discharged at Travis Air Force Base in San Francisco. They paid me for travel from San Francisco to Miami, which was substantial. And in the meantime, I had found out that people returning from overseas could order cars from certain car agencies in Detroit and get them at really good prices. This Sir Hogan Chevrolet in Detroit would offer you cars at $100 above their cost. So I ordered this car. A 67, because it got out in 1950. It was a 67. And the idea was I was going to take my travel pay, you see, and I was going to go from San Francisco to Detroit and pick up my car and then drive home. But when I got to San Francisco, my car wasn't ready. Hadn't been shipped yet. And, because I had come home like 2 weeks earlier than I had expected. And, I flew on home. And when my car, they called me at home when my car was ready, and I flew up to Detroit and got it. But even after flying to Detroit and driving it back, it was still cheaper than it would have been if I bought it in Miami. And so I figured I'd take a few weeks off to go get my car. So I went and got my car, and I drove to Chicago and Boston and all kinds of places. And finally, I went home, and I decided, well, it's time to go back to work. So I got in the car, and I drove up to Patrick Air Force Base because I was on a military leave of absence. Oh, that was another thing. RCA, because I finally had, was amounted to getting drafted, had a position where you could take their military leave of absence. And for 1 year, they paid the difference between my salary with them and my salary in the Air Force. And they gave it to me in one lump sum, which was, you know, like a military leave bonus, which was very nice. So the idea was, you come back off military leave, you go right back to work. So I go back up to RCA. In the meantime, I have gotten all this electronics training and all this radar training, which made RCA very happy, because they were going to send me to a school, but you know, instead the Air Force paid for all that. So I go back, and times were tough at RCA, and I guess they are now, or they're tapering off some, but anyway, RCA and Pan American are the two prime contractors on this missile range, and it's always cyclical like this, you know, times get tough, times get better, times get tough, times get better. And I just happened to get out of the Air Force at a very bad time for RCA, and RCA said, look, you know, the Air Force has made us cut back, and they said, there's not all the jobs available that there used to be, and you know, normally a person returning from military leave of absence could practically name their own job and name their own island. And of course, I wanted to go into radar, and I wanted to go to Grand Bahama, and back to Grand Bahama, and they said, there just isn't anything on Grand Bahama. And they said, now, if you want to go into communications, you can go to Grand Bahama, back into communications. But I had gotten all this training in radar in the Air Force, and I wanted to stay in radar. In the meantime, I had read articles in scientific magazines that RCA had developed a new radar for the missile test range that tracked automatically. It didn't scan like radars do. It locks onto something and just follows it. I thought that would be really interesting to work on. So they said, if you insist on being a radar technician, also the missile test range had gotten longer in the meantime. They said, we've got this island down in the South Atlantic Ocean that we can send you to called Ascension.
Oh, yeah.
Ascension is 36 square miles. It's not as big as Miami. And it's 6 miles across at its longest dimension. And if you go to the top of Green Mountain, you can see the whole island, shore to shore, all the way around. Nothing will grow on Ascension Island because it doesn't get any rain. And so they said, that's where you can go if you want to work in radar. So I thought, oh my God. So everybody's trying to give me a sales talk on Ascension Island. Oh, it's not as bad as it sounds, and believe me, once you get down there, you'll like it, you know. And I kept crying and moaning. I said, this is no way to treat somebody who has been off in the military for 3 years and come back. I said, now come back and you tell me I'm going to Ascension Island. That's horrible, you know. So finally, the downrange instrumentation manager called me in his office, and he said, look, he said, if you will go to Ascension for 6 months, he said, I personally guarantee you that at the end of 6 months, I'll send you to any island you want to go to. So I said, well, no, maybe that's not so bad. So I went down to Ascension. First of all, before I left, these friends of mine who I knew who worked at the Tape invited me for dinner one night. You have to spend a certain time in the States getting shots and getting physical exams and getting your teeth filled and getting a passport and all the different kinds of gobbledygook that you need to go to a place like Ascension, you know. Thousands of shots. I know, shots for diseases I never even heard of before. And, in fact, I was sick about 90% of the time with stupid shots. And they give you a cholera shot, and that 90% of people get sick from cholera shots. But I guess it's better than having cholera. So while I was doing all this processing, these people invited me for dinner, and they said it was a big joke. Something was a big joke when I went to dinner, and my plate was turned upside down, and everybody else's plate was up. You know, and I thought there's something weird going on here.
And when we sat down to dinner and I turned my plate over, there was an issue of National Geographic under my plate, and there was an article in there on Ascension Island, and the caption of the first underneath, it said Ascension Island, and underneath that, in quotes, it said the most barren spot on Earth. And I thought, oh my God. Yeah. So about a couple of days later, I leave for Ascension Island. At 5 o'clock in the morning, the plane leaves for Ascension Island. And what you fly to Ascension Island, and the rest of the people fly in passenger planes to Grand Bahama, Luther, San Felix. You fly to Ascension Island in a Globemaster, great big double-decker thing that hauls cargo, you know? And the seats in a Globemaster are nothing but canvas benches up and down the side of the plane with the cargo sitting right there in front of you, which is all strapped down, you know?
Yo.
There's cylinders of oxygen and hydrogen and nitrogen, these great big long cylinders. There are spare airplane engines for some stupid airplane that needs an engine overhaul down on Ascension, some C-54, some great big engine in there. There's sacks of mail, there's fresh fruits and vegetables, there's all kinds of things in that plane, you know. I even flew back one time with a body in a coffin, you know, strapped down right there in the middle of the plane. Some guy had died down on Ascension and we had to fly him back. But there's no, like on some planes, you know, you put the cargo in one place and the passengers in another. There's everybody's just mixed together, you know, in a Globemaster. We left at 5 o'clock in the morning. We flew to, about 6 hours to Ramey Air Force Base, Puerto Rico. At Ramey Air Force Base, Puerto Rico, the pilots decided that they had an oil leak in one of the engines. Now, they had about as much of an oil leak as I have, but that's what they said. So that was an excuse to stay overnight at Ramey Air Force Base. Well, the crew could take off and go anywhere they wanted. The passengers were not allowed to leave Ramey Air Force Base. So there we were, overnight at Ramey Air Force Base. So got up early the next morning, not early, about 7 o'clock. And we took off and we flew, I think it was 11 hours. And where are we? We're in Suriname. We're in the Zandri Airport of Suriname, which used to be called Dutch Guiana. The Zandri Airport is out in the middle of the jungle. We land there. They put us on buses and they drive us into Paramaribo, which is the capital city of Dutch Guiana, of Suriname. We stay 18 hours in Paramaribo. For what reason, I don't know. We just spent the routine. We stay 18 hours in Dutch Guiana. The next morning, we get back on buses. We go 45 miles back out to the Zandri Airport. We get back on the plane. We fly another 11 hours, and we land at Recife, Brazil. Now, if you fly directly from Dutch Guiana to Recife like this, you can make it in about 6 hours. But you can't fly that way because that's jungle, and there are really headhunters in the jungles of Brazil still. So you fly around like this, around the bowls of South America, so that if you crash, you crash right on the ocean. And which is a comforting thought that you go that way in case you crash. But you know, we land in Recife, Brazil, and we stay 18 hours in Recife, Brazil. This is another crew rest. You know, now why we don't take two crews and go straight on through, I don't know. But anyway, we crew rest every few hours. So we crew rest in Recife, Brazil. They get us up at. Now we get to Recife. Get to Recife about mid-afternoon, I guess. And we stay there all night and all the next day and on into the night sometime. And about 10 o'clock at night, they come around with buses picking us up at the hotels, and we take off in the middle of the night to go to Ascension. And the flight